Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, St. Augustine Poet Laureate Anne Browning Masters.
For me, the local language, the vernacular, is poetic. And when I hear this speech, I hear the voices in speaking narrative poetry.
We'll discuss the Equal Rights Amendment in Florida.
Florida considered ratification three times in 1972, 1974, and 1977, but failed to ratify the amendment.
And we'll preview the new Memory of Negro Fort podcast, co-hosted by our own Sebastian Garcia. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
When their boys rename a beaten-down Yankee bark Three Sisters, they smile. They curtsy. They think they ride a history, but it does not step where they thought.
That's Anne Browning Masters reciting a poem about her ancestor, Lola Sanchez, one of three sisters from St. Augustine who served as Confederate spies in the Civil War. Masters is author of the book Floridanos, Menorcans, Cattle Whip Crackers, Poetry of St. Augustine. She's Poet Laureate of the City of St. Augustine and the Menorcan Cultural Society. She'll be presenting her poetry at the Waterworks in St. Augustine on April 8th and will be participating in the St. Augustine Poet Fest at Flagler College April 9th through 11th. Anne Browning Masters is a native of St. Augustine and a 12th generation Floridian.
In St. Augustine on my mother's side, her family records that are first there in the records with the Catholic Church are in 1602 when Elena Gonzalez married Diego Alvarez. And for almost 100 years, her daughters, granddaughters, continued to marry men who came to St. Augustine. They stayed there. And then in 1702 or 1704, Juana Perez, one of those great granddaughters, married Jose Sanchez de Ortigosa. And so my family line maternally goes with the Sanchez family. My mother's maiden name is Sanchez. So that's what we call Floridano. And the Floridanos are descendants of the Spanish settlers. The paternal side for me is the Menorcan side. And those are the Mediterranean indentured servants who came to St. Augustine in 1777. They had actually come in 1768, to a plantation in New Smyrna, and the plantation failed for various reasons. And amazingly, the British governor gave them relief and allowed them to come to St. Augustine. This was during the British period, and the Floridanos had gone to Spanish colonies or back to Spain. After that 20-year British period, the Floridanos returned, some of them, and they began to marry the Menorcans. So that is where, obviously, in my mother's Floridano side, they married some Menorcans. So for me, it's a blending of those two cultures.
Floridanos, then, are descendants of Florida's first Spanish period settlers. The first Spanish period ended in 1763 when the British took control of Florida for 20 years. During that period, Andrew Turnbull brought indentured servants to Florida to settle New Smyrna. The term Menorcan is used to describe these people and their descendants, although not all of them were from the island of Menorca. Anne Browning Masters.
Menorcans are the indentured servants who came to work in Florida. They are of Italian, Greek, and Menorcan descent. Menorca is one of the Balearic Islands, southeast from Barcelona. And at the time, Menorca was under control of Britain, so it made sense that a British landowner would recruit indentured servants from this Spanish, basically, island of Menorca. Menorca as an island has had everybody and their brother at one time running the show. And so they are very comfortable with the English, particularly, so much so that one of their highways, the main and only highway through the center of the island, is named for one of the British governors who was there a good while back. So that's the imprint of Britain on that particular island.
It's a popular myth in St. Augustine that hot datil peppers arrived in the area when Menorcan settlers brought them here. Extensive research and three trips to Menorca have convinced Anne Browning Masters that the legend is just not true. What is a fact is that Menorcans in St. Augustine have been cooking with datil peppers for many generations, as Masters explains in her poem, The St. Augustine Menorcan Litmus Test.
The St. Augustine Menorcan Litmus Test begins with the green and orange beauties that you grow in 5-gallon pickle buckets, unless your parents or in-laws give you a handful. Put gloves on your Mediterranean hands, for you are about to slice hellfire, cousin, from a 2-inch pepper guaranteed to burn you up alive with those innocent white seeds. Throw those seeds away and chop up that pepper. Sprinkle that flaming dice on some fine perlo. And if you don't have perlo, use beans and rice. And if you don't have beans and rice, are you Menorcan? But I digress. Now take a bite, eat it all. Can you still talk? Do you want the garden hose? If you like what you ate, if you would eat more, we will then call you a good Menorcan.
The third group named in the title of Anne Browning Masters' poetry collection and the third part of her ancestry are cattle whip crackers. The origin of the word cracker probably goes back to the William Shakespeare play The Life and Death of King John. In Act 2, Scene 1 of that play, the Duke of Austria says, "What cracker is this same that deafs our ears with this abundance of superfluous breath?" The Duke was speaking of talkative Scotch-Irish people whose descendants eventually made their way to Florida, bringing the term cracker with them.
There are so many origins for the word. When we go back to the Scotch-Irish, the craic, you know, when you have the talk at the pub and a good time. In America, the corn crackers, that's another derivation. In this case, though, what I'm talking about are people who owned cows, had ranches. In the South, we would say they ran cows. And basically growing up, that was my understanding of that term, although it probably at the same time it did have the pejorative term of a racist that it has now. But that's another derivation or usage for that term. And in my book, I use that term mostly except for one poem where I do use the contemporary usage as a bigot.
In her book, Floridanos, Menorcans, Cattle Whip Crackers, Poetry of St. Augustine, Anne Browning Masters explores her personal heritage, but also addresses historical topics and perspectives.
For me, the local language, the vernacular, is poetic. And when I hear this speech, I hear the voices in speaking narrative poetry, basically. So that's why many of the poems are almost like monologues of characters telling their story. But that's poetry for me.
City of St. Augustine Poet Laureate and Menorcan Cultural Society Poet Laureate Anne Browning Masters will be presenting poems from her book, Floridanos, Menorcans, Cattle Whip Crackers, at the Waterworks in St. Augustine on April 8th and at Poet Fest at Flagler College, April 9th through 11th.
History wrote its own book without our name. Sweet mother, who remembers when this new world began to sliver change among us.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org, where registration is now open for the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum in Daytona Beach, May 28th through 30th. More information is at myfloridahistory.org.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, Kimberly Wilmot Voss, a professor of journalism at the University of Central Florida, is well known to many members of the Florida Historical Society and readers of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Her research focuses on women in journalism and reporting on women's issues.
In a 2009 article in the Quarterly, Voss looks at the media reporting of the several efforts by the Florida State Legislature to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. As she states, the study examines the fight leading up to the 1977 defeat of the measure by looking at the media's coverage of the ERA battles, women versus women themes, and Senator Lori Wilson's mediated representation. The Equal Rights Amendment has a long history. First introduced in both houses of Congress in 1923, it was conceived by Alice Paul. A Quaker, suffragist, and leader of the National Women's Party, she was identified as more radical than many of her fellow suffragists, as she adopted the actions of British suffragettes and organized suffrage parades and picketing before the White House in support of the vote for women. Efforts to bring the ERA before the states for ratification were unsuccessful until 1972, when Congress enacted legislation for the amendment. In quick succession, a number of states ratified the amendment, which stated, quote, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex," end quote. Florida considered ratification three times in 1972, 1974, and 1977, but failed to ratify the amendment. The ERA inaction mimicked earlier consideration of women's rights. In 1920, Florida did not bring the 19th Amendment for woman suffrage before the legislature for ratification, although several cities already allowed women to vote in local elections. In 1969, the legislature symbolically ratified the 19th Amendment. Voss places her work within the context of previous studies on Florida, the South, and the ERA, but distinguishes her research by focusing on the media in reporting the events and determining the outcomes. By focusing attention on a pivotal figure and casting the battles between women as catfights, she says, the media lost the opportunity to engage in the larger role of explaining the impact of the ERA and facilitating broader public discussion.
The consideration of the ERA was time for serious discussion. Labeling it as a catfight seems unnecessarily derogatory.
It does. As with so many aspects of efforts to ratify the ERA, and similar to the push for the 19th Amendment in 1920, labeling the debates between pro and anti-ERA groups as catfights robbed the moment of its policy importance and relegated it to the realm of screeching noise with few historical implications. The ERA mattered to women on both sides of the issues, nor was either side entirely unified in its support or opposition. In addition, both sides argued over the methods to be used in the fight. On the pro-ERA side, divisions between the so-called old guard and new guard, that is, women in professional roles who had been involved in earlier feminist fights, and those new to the fight who often arrived through civil rights, stymied the creation of a unified voice for ERA advocates. Some leaders, such as Betty Friedan, were portrayed as divisive and too removed from typical women to represent their views. They agreed, however, that a constitutional amendment was needed to move women from the status of second-class citizens. In many states, women could not own land, obtain a mortgage, or obtain credit in their own name. Until 1968, a Florida woman who wanted to go into business on her own had to petition the court to demonstrate her competence and good character. More unified in their opposition, The anti-ERA arguments focused on concerns that ratification of the amendment would lead to unisex bathrooms, the elimination of alimony, and the legalization of gay marriage. Voss notes that the two reasons most cited for opposition to the ERA were conscription of women into the military service and the breakdown of the family. Citing other studies, Voss notes that in the South, feminism competed for space within the public rhetoric still struggling with issues of race. As an example, she points to claims of anti-family lodged against ERA supporters who advocated government-supported daycare. Opponents claimed the centers created by the ERA would take children away from their families, just as busing had literally taken children away from their families in the process of desegregation.
Connie, how did the media depict these differences and influence the outcome of the ratification?
Voss argues that the language used by the media was condescending and negative. As an example, the women's strike for equality on August 26, 1970, was the largest women's protest in American history to that point. But media coverage focused on throwaway quips by men. Vice President Spiro Agnew noted that three things have been difficult to tame: the oceans, fools, and women. We may soon be able to tame the ocean, but fools and women will take a little longer. On the national level, not all ERA proponents saw the media as unsupportive. Activist Susan Brown Miller, historian Carol Mueller, and journalist David Broder point to the role newspapers and magazines played in highlighting the issues and unifying the forces of ratification. Voss points to the media failure to provide analysis of the amendment and questions the claims by each side as contributing to the state's failure to ratify the ERA. While most newspapers focused on the catfight that erupted between the opposing sides, polls indicated that Floridians supported ratifications by a wide margin. Political figures who claimed that the people of Florida don't want the ERA to pass were not challenged. On the editorial pages, letters for and against ratification were paired, giving the impression that support for the amendment was weaker than the polls indicated. Both the Miami Herald and the St. Petersburg Times championed the ERA, but even there, the support was framed by male journalists, since women played a limited role in the creation of mainstream media messages. In addition to shaping the rhetoric, media focused on personalities rather than messages. The emergence of Gloria Steinem and Phyllis Schlafly provided media with national figures who were articulate and photogenic. In Florida, that role was played by Brevard Senator Lori Wilson. Elected as an independent, she emerged as the sponsor and principal advocate of the ERA in Florida. In a speech before the Senate on April 10, 1974, she tied ratification of the ERA to the nation's history of liberty, but did not move the legislature to ratification. By January 1977, ratification seemed in reach. 18 senators vowed to support ERA and 13 were against, leaving 9 senators undeclared. By April, however, a series of vote switches put ratification in doubt. When the measure failed, Wilson placed the blame on, quote, the good old boys in southern legislatures, but she predicted they were clutching at pseudo-power that will not last. Voss concludes that the blame fell on several actors. The Florida ERA was not well organized and did not spend time debunking anti-ERA myths. But she saves her principal blame for the media, for its failure to analyze the issues or use the polling numbers to question the statements by elected officials that the people did not want the ERA. She also notes that although Senator Wilson commanded the attention of the media, journalists used her image frequently but gave her little airtime. The role of the media, Voss concludes, should be considered as a factor in the defeat of the ERA in the Florida legislature.
It's amazing that this legislation still hasn't become law. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Our own Sebastian Garcia is co-host of the new podcast, Memory of Negro Fort, and he has a preview for us.
The Memory of Negro Fort podcast tells the story of how and why Americans have remembered and erased the largest autonomous community of runaway enslaved people and Native Americans in the history of the United States. For the past year, I have co-produced this podcast with UCF graduate history student John Lancaster and with support from other individuals, including UCF history professors Dr. Barbara Gannon and Dr. Scott French. This excerpt plays the first 7 minutes of episode one. It opens at a critical juncture in the history of Negro Fort, setting up the guiding questions of the series and of this first episode.
Hold your fire! Hold your fire!
On July 23rd, 1816, the Battle of Negro Fort reached a critical turning point. Under a flag of truce, American allied Creeks, exhausted from almost a week of fighting, plodded through the thick humidity of the Florida woods. They approached an intimidating fort atop a high bluff along the Apalachicola River. As they neared the imposing citadel, a formidable figure came into their view over the walls of the fort.
Garcon, a 30-year-old carpenter and commander of the fort, observed the American gunboats raise the white flag and deploy their Creek allies to negotiate the fort's surrender. Formerly enslaved and with a Francophone name, Garcon likely hailed from a French colony in the Americas. Like other formerly enslaved people, Garcon found freedom at the fort and refused to surrender it at all costs. A week of combat against the Americans demonstrated his successful defense of the fort and its autonomy, as the Americans struggled to advance up the bluff. Unsurprisingly then, Garcon ridiculed the Americans' demand for the fort's surrender, scolding the Creeks as they returned to the American gunboats.
From the river below, the Americans watched a red flag ascend through the clouds of smoke that lingered over the looming fort. Garcon decided to raise the red flag of no surrender to signal that he and the fort's inhabitants preferred to fight to the death rather than live in bondage.
This choice came at a cost.
I am Sebastian Garcia.
I am John Lancaster.
And this is the Memory of Negro Fort podcast.
Episode 1, A Multiracial World.
The Memory of Negro Fort podcast tells the story of how and why Americans have remembered and erased the memory of the largest autonomous community of runaway enslaved people and Native Americans in the history of the United States. To begin uncovering the memory of this free community that American statesmen and soldiers labeled Negro Fort, we must first understand its history. History refers to the reconstruction of the past through critical analysis of surviving records. It is therefore rooted in the concrete and is determined to represent past events authentically. Memory, on the other hand, is rooted in the present, always evolving and subject to both remembering and forgetting. After a historical event occurs, its memory begins, as various groups and people remember or forget aspects of it to fit their own worldviews.
In July 1816, Negro Fort stood at the intersection between several larger histories, including the legacies of frontier violence between Native Americans and white settlers in the 18th century, the War of 1812 and its goal of American expansion, escalating frictions between the United States and Spanish-controlled Florida, and the growing reliance on enslaved labor in the American South during the early 19th century.
The fort's creation was a product of the War of 1812. The conflict occurred at a moment when the U.S. sought to expand its territory into indigenous lands, and the Southern planter class increasingly viewed enslaved labor as a cornerstone of their economy and way of life. As a result, the war concretized the historical issues of violence on the southern frontier between white settlers and indigenous people, and the desire of some in the U.S. to expand the institution of slavery into territories like Florida.
At the same time, the ideological creation of the site as Negro Fort revealed the growing racial hierarchy of the early republic, as the community of free black and indigenous people who lived there undermined the new nation's social order. The persisting memory, and sometimes oblivion, of Negro Fort underlines the importance that issues like race, national identity, power, and violence have had on the history of the United States.
The Battle of Negro Fort, which occurred between July 15th and July 27th, 1816, gave a physical battleground for the American Creek forces and individuals like Garçon to play out and contend with these real issues of their time and place. To understand why Garçon decided to hoist the red flag of no surrender on July 23rd, we must first situate ourselves in the decades following American independence and ask, how did the failure to address slavery in the Constitution encourage white Southerners to expand their plantation system across the southern frontier? How did this desire to expand slavery across the southern frontier influence both black and native people to flee into Spanish Florida? What made Spanish Florida a compelling destination to avoid further enslavement and displacement for these subjugated peoples of the United States? And how did decades of these interrelated issues of frontier violence, the southern expansion of slavery, and indigenous dispossession culminate in a full-scale conflict with the War of 1812, a conflict that led to the creation of the so-called Negro Fort?
To begin answering these questions, we will briefly travel to Independence Hall and the drafting of the Constitution. We will then head south to places like South Carolina and Georgia, where white settlers continue to violently displace indigenous people from their lands. Such displacement pushes them, and us, into Spanish Florida, a multiracial and multi-ethnic world on the southern border of the United States that provokes anxieties for the slave-owning class who do not yet control it. We will then traverse this southward path again through the lens of one such slave owner and crucial figure in the history of Negro Fort, Andrew Jackson. These diverse perspectives offer a comprehensive view as to why the decades following American independence help explain the immense stakes carried by Garçon, the fort's inhabitants, and the American Creek belligerents during the Battle of Negro Fort.
To join us in our journey back in time and answering these questions about Negro Fort, please follow and listen to the Memory of Negro Fort podcast on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever else you get your podcast. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and find us anytime at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.